Good afternoon, brothers and sisters, Sunday school scholars, respected guests. Since we started a bit early this afternoon, I figured I'd just pick up where Seth left off last night, speaking about the voting procedures of the Christadelphians. Anybody? Too soon? Sorry. However, in today's class, we will continue our study with the 10th chapter of Ecclesiastes. Now, over the years, I have come to think of Ecclesiastes as somewhat of a primer, if you will, that collected all of King Solomon's thoughts on man's nature, his environment, and the purpose behind it all. Much of Solomon's message is based on the first three chapters of Genesis, highlighting the importance of these first principle foundations. Later on, even in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul's use of the principles and language of Ecclesiastes throughout his epistles is a clear indication of the very practical advice and wealth of foundation material contained within its pages. Now, I'm going to be honest. It's usually easier for me as a speaker to comment or speak on subjects as a whole, but given the somewhat fragmented and cryptic nature of the wording of this chapter, and indeed Ecclesiastes itself, I thought it would be best to proceed verse by verse. Starting with verse 1, we read, "Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor." Quite honestly, the first thing I thought of when I read this was, that's a nice visual. But the point is well driven home. Just one little dead fly can contaminate an otherwise good salve or ointment. And just as likely, a person can be well esteemed, well thought of, known for being smart, considerate, overall great character. And then with one small slip-up, one scandal, even the rumor of a scandal can destroy that perception in an instant. Endless examples abound us around us all that's in this day and age. Verses 2 and 3 read, "A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to every one that he is a fool." What we can surmise here, of course, is the juxtaposition of the wise and foolish. True wisdom, on one hand, embracing the understanding of the work of the Lord Jesus Christ, it becomes a support to the wise. But the fool, whose heart is at his left, trusts in faulty beliefs, and his heart will fail him at his time of need. And just by those actions, he unconsciously portrays himself as a fool. Moving on, verse 4 reads, "If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses." Now to me, this verse pretty much states, hypothetically, if the king's anger becomes directed at you, don't just take your ball and go home. Don't leave. Accept the admonition with grace, humbleness, and by doing so, diffuse the situation. A good cross-reference I found on that was Proverbs 19, verses 11 and 12, which reads, "The discretion of a man deferreth his anger, and it is his glory to pass over a transgression. The king's wrath is as the roaring of a lion, but his favor is as dew upon the grass." Now we read in verses 5 through 7, "There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth." The evil here refers to errors in governing and abuse of power by those in high places. By appointing the wrong people to office, the entire hierarchy is turned on its ear. Wise men, which are meant to rule, end up holding menial positions, and those, shall we say, less than qualified, are in exalted positions. Continuing on in verses 8 and 9, "He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby." These verses and a few later on in this chapter are prime examples of cause and effect. someone who's preparing a trap, such as pit or a snare, sometimes they'll forget that they laid it and just be walking along and going to get caught in it. And in the Middle East, there are stone fences, or hedges they call them, that surround houses and fields. And subsequently, those become nice hiding places for snakes. So if someone was attempting to rob the house, they would have to break the hedge to get in and then run the risk of getting bitten by said serpent and die. So moving on in verse 10, we read, "If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct." This is a pretty important verse to me. It spells out that preparation, very key in saving energy in any conflict or event. Think of it as trying to cut down a tree with a dull chainsaw. Sure, eventually you might cut the tree down, but you will have to work much harder than if you chose to sharpen the chainsaw beforehand. And brothers and sisters, this applies directly to our spiritual lives. For truthfully, how can we expect to wage warfare against sin with little or no preparation? We as brothers and sisters must be there for each other, for as it states in Proverbs 27, verse 17, "Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend." Next we read in verse 11, "Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better." I had a bit of trouble with this one. I'm sure though, someone might be able to clear it up more. In essence, it sounds like we're being told here that deadly snakes will strike without warning, giving the victim no evidence of its presence before it's too late. Much like that, a babbler, flatterer, or slanderer, I think Strong says master of the tongue, can have the same effect on a person's reputation, their words working their evil and doing damage very quickly. Verses 12 through 15 kind of go hand in hand, so I'll read them all together. "The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city." Verse 12 is fairly straightforward. Simply put, a wise man will speak words of positivity so as not to offend someone. I equate this with Psalms 15:1, which tells us, "A soft answer turn away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger." The second part of this verse, I would have to say, is somewhat of the precursor to the saying, "Better to have people think of you as a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt." And this thought continues in verse 13, basically stating that everything they do, from start to finish, is foolishness. There is nothing wise or constructive in any part of what they say or do. Verse 14 also reminds us that a fool is full of words, meaning that, of course, they can't just say one idiotic thing and leave it at that. They tend to ramble on and with their nonsense, digging themselves deeper with every single word. And who can tell them any different? No one, for a fool thinks he knows everything. Predictably, this tends to wear on everyone. As for the latter part of verse 15, "because he knoweth not how to go to the city," I heard a few differing explanations on this. The one that seems to make the most sense was that the road to Jerusalem back then in Solomon's time was pretty clearly marked and simple to follow. But the fool wears himself out looking for a shortcut or an easier road to travel. And likewise, the straight and narrow way to life is clearly marked by the Bible, but many wear themselves out trying to take the easy road through life. And as we know, while that road may have less bumps in construction, well, at least less than Arkansas, ultimately it leads nowhere. Just moving on to verses 16 and 17. "Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season. for strength and not for drunkenness. Just a couple words briefly about these two verses. I do think that Solomon is referring to a king, of course, who acts like a child, not one who in fact is a child, although this in itself isn't unprecedented. It is altogether preferable, of course, to have a king or a leader who is wise and fair, so that all that are under their guidance can prosper. Verse 18 reads, "By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through the idleness of the hands the house droppeth through." I would say this verse pretty much relates to the childish and negligent rule of the king mentioned in verse 16. Now, historically, the words house and building refer to a nation, and such poor management or ruling of a nation would no doubt lead to their eventual downfall. This can also be a parallel to our spiritual lives. For if we fail to be diligent in our studies or fellowshipping with others, idleness can leave us susceptible to the world and its temptations, and as such, destroy the strength of our convictions and beliefs. Moving on to verse 19. "A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things." This verse, above all the rest in this chapter, is probably the most misunderstood. Proponents of Billy Graham and Joel Osteen tend to point to this verse as if to say, "You see, the Bible does say it is okay to be well off." But what they fail to understand is that on its own, this verse is taken out of context, and as a whole, again speaks to the mindset of the foolish rulers back in verse 16, who in no doubt think, sure, the building or nation may be decaying, but we can eat, drink, and be merry because we have money, and money solves everything, right? Wrong. It is plainly written in Matthew 19 and 23, "And again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God." Our last verse, 20, reads, "Curse not the king, no, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber. For a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter." Brothers and sisters, this verse is still very applicable to us today. We need to watch what we say about those who are powerful and who are rich, for there is no telling who may be listening and who will relay the message back to that person. Now, depending on who that person is and what mood they happen to be in that day, the repercussions could be quite disastrous. More than likely, this is where the saying, "a little bird told me," came from. For even if you think someone isn't listening, even in a place as private as your own bedchamber, you need to exercise restraint in talking badly about anyone. This, of course, is great advice for all of us. Now, in conclusion, I do apologize for having just to touch briefly on each verse or section. For each of the verses in this chapter could probably result in its own separate study class, some even their own exhortation or lecture. That being said, I very much look forward to hearing your comments and discussion.
Thank Noah for his opening remarks. He's given us some ideas to start off our discussion period with. So we'll open this for comments from the floor. Anyone have any comments? Brother Burrow?
Come back to the first verse. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. That first part, as we were reading it, it kind of brought to mind just how little things upset us so much and cause, you know, great harm and great hurt. You know, you take it back to Haman from Esther's time. You know, it was a little thing that he didn't get bowed down to. But it was a big thing to him. It was basically nothing. You know, it was one of those little vanities that Solomon says all is vanity. He didn't get bowed down to, and it ate and it festered and it grew and it made life stink. And at the end, it cost him everything. It cost him his family. It cost him his life, his family's life. It's just a little thing. Most things in life, no matter how big we think they are little things in comparison to the works of God, to the kingdom of God. And that little fly, you know, just ruined a whole batch of ointment that Solomon's pointing out. And that little fly in our lives can ruin everything for us. So it kind of behooves us to realize that there's, as other brethren have said throughout this whole week, there's nothing in this life worth getting upset over. It's not worth anger or getting your salvation in jeopardy for. And these are little things.
Brother Glendon?
Thanks, Brother Noah, and thanks, Brother Burrell, actually, as well. I was just looking at this verse 10, and Brother Burrell kind of gives an introduction to it, actually. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, he must put to more strength. And, of course, Brother Noah brought out the cross-reference there to Proverbs 27:17. A man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. As iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. There's a really good exhortation, I think, in sharpening a piece of iron. Now and then I'll have a really dull chunk of iron that needs to be worked over, and I'll take it up to Dennis and Elsie Redmond. Some of you all know them, just up the road there, Sandy's parents, Kelly's parents. And Dennis always says, every time somebody uses this grinder, yeah, you can use it, but make sure you take some water with you. He always wants you to quench the steel as you're working it. You know, you're working it on that grinder, and you know everything looks fine. You're thinking that steel's not heating up very much, but you start looking really close at the edge of it, and where that metal's really thin, and it's heated so up so much, you've got this rainbow strip of colors through there because you've actually melted the steel down. And ironically, what they call that is losing the temper. Steel loses its temper, and you know. I guess therein lies the exhortation. When we're working with our brothers and sisters and we're supposed to be sharpening one another, there shouldn't be a lot of strife and heat in the form of losing your temper. It's one thing to take a block of steel and try to make a knife out of it. Yeah, there'll probably be a lot of sparks there. But once you have the basic shape of a blade, it takes a slow, constant effort. And one of the essential ingredients for getting a really good edge is oil. I think there's some good significance in that as well. If you don't apply that oil, what you have is that all the heat is concentrated at the edge of the blade, and you'll never get a good sharp edge because you're always melting away what you're sharpening. But you add oil, and we can think of oil as the Word. We add the Word and the Spirit that it guides us to, and we put that into effect, then the heat is dissipated. That's exactly what oil does when you're sharpening a blade. It dissipates the heat away from the edge, and it reduces any sparks. There's no sparks. As soon as you add the oil of the Word, the contention ceases, and you're three times as effective as you were without it. So it's really neat exhortation there.
Brother Gordon?
You know, so I just wanted to go back to that verse 1 there, and thank you, Brother Noah, for your comments on it. It's one of the characteristics of human nature is that we tend to think of people either as a hero or, if not that, a villain. Like, we tend to be extreme, and especially when we're young, we kind of forget. We maybe idealize people, and then we find out that they have failings, and then they fall right down to basically being a villain in our sight. And it's just one of those things that, especially as we're young, we have to remember that everybody has faults, regardless of how good you may think they are. And even those that seem to be bad characters, whatever, have some good points. So it's just a case of learning to be fair in our assessment of people.
Brother David Somerville.
I enjoyed Brother Noah's comments there on the iron being sharpened and the importance of putting the effort in ahead of time. You think about the job you have to do and make sure you have the tools and our fight against sinful flesh. And I thought that was a great point. He asked a question about the 11th verse. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and the babbler is no better. Another word for a babbler is a gossiper. And maybe serpent isn't the best thing to think of. Maybe for where we are, maybe a spider. If we kind of saw a big spider and just let it run around, especially if it was, I think it's a recluse that's on the board there that's poisonous. If we just let it run around and nobody really paid much attention to it, somebody's going to get bit from it. And the same thing with a serpent. If you just let it go around and nobody's enchanted it or nobody's controlling it, somebody's going to get bit. And it's the same thing with the gossiper. If we allow gossiping to go around, somebody's going to get poisoned by those words.
Brother Sid Jones.
Yes, thank the brethren for their comments, and I was also looking at the 11th verse, and I think it really is. I think we're on the right track there, thinking about preparation, and I believe it's in Ephesians, it talks about having our feet shod with the preparation of the gospel, and but it's interesting. I've got a Revised Standard Version here, and it comes out a little different when you read it from there. If the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage in a charmer. And you can see that a charmer, making whatever noise he makes with his flute or however they do it, once the serpent has bitten somebody, he's like a babbler. He's just making noise. He's just be more of an annoyance. But when you think to what is the serpent's bite? We look at the role of the serpent in Bible symbology, and it is sin in the flesh, and its bite is death. And when we see or hear people providing a false hope as a security against the serpent's bite, It is of no value. There's no preparation in it. We know that the preparation of the gospel is to have the truth, to believe it, and to do the works that result from that, so that the serpent is taken care of ahead of time. It's like, I think Brother Thomas wrote quite often about the deathbed confession. We've got to make steps ahead to prepare for the serpent's bite.
Brother Jim?
Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, another comment on verse 10. About the dull axe, and the if no one sharpens it, then the person using it must expend more energy. And that's a truism we can all relate to. Takes preparation ahead of time to sharpen it. But if you went to my house, you'd look at my hatchet, and you'll probably find it dull. In the same way with my drill case, you'll find most of my drills dull. And I use them dull. How stupid can he be? But I also have a wisdom to know that I'm not the guy to sharpen them, because they're going to be worse if I put a grindstone to the end of my axe or my hatchet or something like that. I'm going to make a bigger mess out of it than if I just leave it alone and use it the way it is, as bad as it is. And that also takes a certain amount of wisdom. As iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. It can create a lot of sparks and a lot of heat. I know, you put me next to a grindstone and you'll see a lot of sparks and a lot of heat, and the end result is worse than I started. It takes a skill, a certain amount of training, a certain amount of wisdom. The last thing David did before he left for a summer vacation was drop off two or three lawnmower blades at my house that he had sharpened for me. He's a machinist, not me. You know, I give them to him, he sharpens them for me. And it's the wisdom to know what you can do and what you can't do. And yes, it takes preparation, but it also takes a certain amount of skill. And there's no excuse for us not having that skill in the truth. We have an obligation to each other, and we should be able to deal with one another and sharpen our continence. But we need to develop the skill to do it properly and not make a bigger mess of it.
Brother Burrow?
In the eighth verse, he that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Well, the word used in Hebrew for bite is often the same word used for usury. And when you think about it, that's a good reference to what interest is. Well, you know, if you go out and you keep borrowing money, you're digging that pit, and that interest is going to bite you. And we're not supposed to go out and borrow money. If we do borrow, we're supposed to pay it back. And I know it's a fact of modern life. You can't buy a house without borrowing money. Most people can't buy a car without borrowing money. But that interest is a bite. That interest is a sore pain. You're now obligated to repay a debt more than what you borrowed. And if you don't pay, there's all kinds of negative consequences to not paying, including your reputation, and that's a thing of value to a brother of Christ, because we want to be known as in the world as people who live life as Christ did. So this biting of a serpent is a bad thing. You know, just like any serpent bite is a bad thing. And the biting of interest is something that will drag a person down into that pit that make it extremely difficult to get out of.
Brother Seth Brown?
There's much been said about the dull axe this afternoon. A lot of the comments have danced around this common expression, but no one said it expressly, and that is, work smarter, not harder. And that's pretty much what the verse is saying in Brother Noah's example of the chainsaw. The smart thing to do is, you sharpen it. Cut through the tree in no time. You don't sharpen it, it's going to take twice as long, maybe three times as long, and you're working very hard at it, you're getting frustrated, but in the end you got to realize that was foolish. But there was something that occurred to me about this work smarter and not harder. There have been times where I'd hear from people that come to the faith, become Christadelphians, brand Christadelphians, and sometimes they will say something along the lines of, I heard what you were saying. It just seemed so simple, so quickly to the point. I didn't have to think too much about it. It just seemed natural. But then we have seen in the lectures this week, especially when it comes to first principles, the hoops that people have to jump through to change Christianity into a pagan slant, to make things like heaven, hell, and immortality of the soul come about. They have to work very hard to do all of this, to try to twist the simple words of God into their doctrine. And there's a saying, the wisdom of this world is foolish with God. And another thing is, the things that would seem foolish to God could still confound the wise. There is no getting around the smartness of God, the complete and utter wisdom. And with this simple plan, we deal with this simple plan, we are working smart. The opponents of the gospel truth are working very hard, and their efforts are just going to fail.
Brother Dan Jackson.
Just have a couple of things. Somewhere between, I'm not sure who said it back here about the Acts, I think it might have been Sid and Brother Jim. Just throw this out there that when Brother Jim does take it to the proper person who sharpens the axe and does a proper job on that and the drill bits, it seems like there's still sparks no matter what, but the end result is what you're looking for, is a sharp axe and a sharp drill bit. So sometimes that happens, and we just have to keep that in mind when dealing with each other. What I was going to comment on was on verse 2. It said, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. And it's interesting, when dealing with Scripture, the right hand has always been an indication of strength. The left hand is always an indication of weakness. And we know that from throughout the Scriptures. I think there's 137 mentions of right hand in the Bible. And we know that the accepted in the end are referred to as being on Christ's right hand. Christ was taken up into heaven and placed at the right hand of God. And so when we look at chapter 10, it does not contain the word vanity, but it does contain the words wisdom and foolishness throughout. So we can see right following that in verse 3, which says, even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks strength. Because wisdom, it already said, is on the right hand. So you can read that and interchange words there and show the strength and the weakness of wisdom and foolishness. That was a neat analogy.
Brother Lenny?
A general comment first. This chapter seems to be a lot of, you know, not so much relating to experiences, but observations of wisdom and folly, as Brother Dan was bringing out a little bit, much sort of like the Proverbs is written. But I was, but unlike the Proverbs, I was looking at the 18th verse. You know, Proverbs would give you the wise thing and then give you the foolish thing and so on so often. But 18 makes a statement, by much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. And the thought is over. So what's the point? Well, we all know if we have an asset, whatever it might be, a house, a car, a microwave oven, whatever, if we don't care for it, it'll eventually wear out, deteriorate, certainly lose its value. And of course, you know, the obvious to us here, of course, is when we come to the greatest asset that we could possibly possess, and that being, of course, the truth of God, it's knowledge. You know, once we obtain it, like once we obtain a house or any other valuable asset, it needs maintenance. It needs work. We need to continue to work at it. And so what I get out of this verse is that though he doesn't tell us what to do, he's telling us the danger of how we could lose things. And particularly, you know, we could lose the truth if we don't constantly keep it sharp. Even as we're talking about, you know, sharpening iron, we need to keep our minds sharp, our hearts in the right place. And so we'll be prepared and ready for that day of his return.
Brother Pat Brown?
Yeah.
Wait till the mic comes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't carry my voice too far anyway. Yeah, okay. I'd like to thank
Brother Jim Somerville for bringing up the idea of his tools being dull, because when Linda married me, she thought she married a handyman. Well, I was very handy with everything else but the house. So I had to find some way to get enough money in a job to be able to have somebody else do the house. And so it's almost the same kind of idea. It's finding, if you can't find it yourself, find the expert to do it. And where the scriptures are concerned, it is so comfortable to me that I don't have to worry about how to take care of all this stuff out here with the world. Try to straighten it all out, you know. That I can look to Isaiah where it says, his thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. But we're told not to trust in our own heart, otherwise we'll be a fool. So we have to make his thoughts to take care of our thoughts. Like Jesus said, when Jesus said, my doctrine is not mine, but his that sent me, we also can realize, as he did when he was ready to be crucified, he says, not my will, but thine be done. And that's one of the things I took out of this today, was through all of the sharpening and everything else, I'm glad that it was brought up about the water. I'm sure that many saw that I would have done, probably would have looked like, some other kind of tool when it got done. But I thank the brethren for their remarks, and it's really been very, very helpful.
Brother Glendon.
I was just going to make a comment on that very last verse there. It's really neat to go through Ecclesiastes and once you find the principle of the verse, find where Christ talks about it in the New Testament. And just about every one of them you can find a direct shadowing of Ecclesiastes in the life of Christ, or maybe vice versa, I should say. Anyway, the one I was looking at just now is at verse 20, curse not the king, no, not in thy thought. Curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. And I guess really what it's going back to is this idea of gossip. And might do well to just read out this portion of Matthew 18 that I was looking at. Moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. Anyway, there's this tendency, at least I have the tendency, I'm sure everyone else does as well. You know, when someone does something wrong, you really feel like you have to talk to someone about it. So you think, well, it'll probably be all right if I talk to my best friend about it. I can trust them. Or maybe I'll just talk to my spouse about it. Or maybe I'll just talk to this or that brother in the ecclesia that I'm really close to and I've gone to for advice a lot of times. And talk to them about it first. And then go talk to the person. But he really gives us a solemn warning here. Curse not the rich, or you may put in there, your brother who's offended you, even in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. And we know what that's like when that does get out. In a lot of cases, it's just like a spark on a dry hay field. All it takes is a little bit of it to get out, and all of a sudden you've got this fire that's raging out of control, when really the root of it was only a small little issue that you could have dealt with, had you just addressed it with the individual concerned in the beginning before you let it get out somewhere else.
Brother David Somerville.
That was a good point you made there, Glendon, about how we take care of things, and just kind of bring us back full circle to the first comment you made. As a school teacher, having dull tools creates a huge safety issue. Students get hurt, and I have to answer for why they're using dull tools. So not only does it make more work, but it also will create injury. Other people can get hurt from us not being, as the example was brought out by Brother Noah, if we're not prepared, it's not only more work, but it could be more damage. In the 15th verse there, it says, "The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not the way to go to the city." Now, the way to the city should have been the clear way marked. That should be the easy way to go. All the roads, you know, you get out in the farm area, you can get lost, but heading into the city, there should be a main road heading into the city. But the fool can't stay on that road and keeps getting lost, and it's wearing everybody. And, you know, when we get out of this meeting, we're all going to line up and head in a caravan to the outing and think about how much we would be wearied if we just went on a couple-hour ride around Texas and never made it to where we were going. You know, it's still saying the same message. We need to be prepared. If a fool would just kind of go off the fly from the seat of his pants and have no direction, a wise man will figure out where he's going to go and stay the path. And it's the same thing with us in the truth. It's not as easy as getting into the city. It's not the broad way that we're going to try and stay on. We're trying to stay on the straight and narrow path. It's tough, but it's through hard work and the wisdom that we gain from the scriptures that we can stay on that path.
Brother Dan Jackson.
We've been talking a lot about the sharpening of the saw, and I don't really want to dwell on that too much longer. But the whole chapter really deals on that, doesn't it? Is with wisdom and foolishness, and what Brother Glennon brought out. I guess it was Brother Glennon, not Brother Sid. Sorry about that. That was talking about originally the sharpening of the saw and using the water. But anyways, if we move to verse 18. It all is related to that, and he says, "Because of laziness," in my version says, "Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks." It reminds me of the state we are in right now, and that reminds me when we flip to Revelation, and to the angel of the ecclesia of Laodiceans. "I know your works, whether you're neither hot nor cold. I wish you were hot or cold. So then, because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I will vomit you out of my mouth. Because you say, 'I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing,' and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked." It's the whole message of what Ecclesiastes has been trying to say. If we chase after these things in life, because we, in today's life, we have everything and anything we want. And in doing this, what we're actually doing is letting the house leak, and our building is decaying. And what we need to do is shore it up by the word of truth. And as Glennon brought out in his analogy of the water, of the word, the oil of gladness, sharpening edge, iron sharpeneth iron. All these things are necessary to maintain the truth, not only in our own lives, but in the ecclesia, the ecclesias. That we're here to help each other along this road. Otherwise, when Christ comes, the question will be, where will I find the faith?
We have time for one or two more comments, if anyone has a comment. Brother, I forgot your name.
Matthews. That covers it. I just wanted to make a quick comment on those verses there which make reference to the evil which proceeds from the ruler. It says about folly being set in great dignity, the rich sitting in low place. servants upon horses, princes walking as servants. You know, you can imagine a revolution which has upturned the status quo sort of thing, and things have turned upside down. There's a verse in the Proverbs which says that when the wicked rule, vile men are on every hand. We find that we look at some of the wicked regimes, and it's, and you find it's not just the tyrant who's there. He's got a collection of henchmen who are more than happy to carry out deeds of great wickedness and cruelty. I thought by contrast it would be interesting to think about what Isaiah 32 says. The chapter opens in a beautiful way and says, "Behold, a king shall rule in righteousness and princes in judgment." The chapter goes on to say, "The vile person shall no more be called liberal, nor the churl said to be bountiful." And we've got painted to us a picture of a time when we shall no more have to worry about what the presidents and prime ministers of the present age do. We can expect nothing but folly from an enlightened flesh. But when Christ returns, we know that all the evils, all the wickedness, and all the upturning of the status quo that we've got depicted here will be reversed, and instead we'll have equity and righteousness when he shall rule from sea to sea, from the river and to the ends of the earth, and when the whole earth shall dwell in righteousness.
We're out of time. We thank our brethren for their comments, and we thank Brother Noah for his remarks. Mm-hmm.